Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us on a different day, same time. I thank you all for being so accommodating with your schedule. I'm very excited about the topic that we're going to discuss today. It is with great pleasure to have our first returning guest today. As usual, if we jump ahead to the agenda, we're going to go through some numbers and just give an overview of where we are at as a country and, you know, with a special attention to where we're at in Florida. And hopefully today we can have a discussion around where we're going. So if you go to the next slide, Ian, currently in the world, we're over 14 million cases, with the United States leading, Brazil close behind. If we take a closer look at what's happening in the United States on our next slide, you'll see that we're at over 3.8 million cases. And according to whichever site you're leaning into and looking at, the numbers may be a little bit different. So this was an update from on the Johns Hopkins site this morning at around 9:30. I've seen on the Worldometer that we're at 3.9, so I think there is going to be some variability in those numbers until everything gets aligned by this evening. What that means is that we're over 140,000 deaths in this country, and we're going to talk in a minute about those cases that have recovered. So if you move forward, this is just a snapshot of Florida. And as many of you on the call are aware, Florida we're still having the surge that we're seeing. And I think, I think there, much of this is secondary to the fact that our state reopened in a way that probably wasn't advised, and some parts of our state are still seeing those reopenings. Others have other areas, like the place that I'm in, South Florida, we've gone through more shutdowns and restrictions to help to drive those numbers down. But looking at the cases this morning, Miami-Dade is over 89,000. Broward County, where I sit, is over 42,000 cases, and Palm Beach, which helps make up that Tri-County area, is over 26,000. So we still see that we're in a surge. And if you're listening to the news or watching the news or however you take in information, you'll probably be hearing about Florida for the upcoming days. Where that brings us to, if you move to the next slide, is in our conversation that we're gonna have today. The number that I don't think I've ever highlighted on our call, and that may not get as much attention, is around recovered and discharged patients. So this is from the Worldometer. And the top, if you look at this graphic at the top, the green line represents the recovery rate. And they're saying through July 20th, the recovery rate is around 92.79%. And the death rate through July 20th is 7.21%, meaning that over 1.8 million individuals have recovered or been discharged. And that number, in my opinion, is a little loose, because discharged and recovered means that the tests are negative and that you're able to get out of the hospital. But as we talk about it today, recovered, I think, means a lot. And we may not be seeing people return to their baseline. So it brings us to the conversation, and if you advance to the next slide, that we're gonna have today around the post-COVID sequelae, and really discussing what recovery looks like. You know, we're in a unique situation with our setting being post-acute long-term care, where we are going to see patients become ill from the disease, contract the disease, may have outbreaks at our facilities, but we're also on the receiving end of patients coming out of the nursing facility. So I wanted to bring in two special guests. if you go back to the slide, one, Dr. Healy, who was actually our first guest on Journal Club back on, oh my gosh, April 1st, I believe. Yeah. And then Liz Vanderbilt, did I say your name right, Liz? Yeah, who was our guest back in May, on May 13th, that brought us the coining of the term fluid rounds. Because both of them have been dealing with outbreaks. Dr. Healy in New Rochelle and Liz over at Fort Myers both have seen patients go out to the hospital and been on that on the front lines fighting this condition, this disease. And they're in a unique position to now educate us, even though we're seeing surges here in Florida and other states. We need that education of what happens when we get those patients back from the hospital, or if they're in our facility on a lockdown, on a isolation unit, what is the anticipated recovery and rehabilitation? What does it all look like? So I'm gonna let them introduce themselves. Dr. Healy, we can begin with you.
Hello, everybody. My name is Elaine Healy. I'm the medical director of a 300-bed nursing home in New Rochelle, New York. And New Rochelle is very, very close to New York City. It's basically the first city in Westchester, just north of New York. And we had the dubious distinction of having the first COVID positive case in New York State. And we were very much caught up in the whole COVID phenomena very early on. So as Diane said, I hope to be able to just share with you our experience. We're a number of weeks ahead of you, so to speak, in the timeline. So if that's helpful, I'll be glad to let you know what we've learned over here.
And Liz, can you introduce yourself before we go into further discussion?
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you again for having me share my experience over here on the west coast of Florida. My territory stretches all that dark blue that you just showed on that map, Dr. Sanders, but my territory stretches from South Tampa down to nearly Naples, which is about a 200-mile distribution, and I'm the clinical service manager for the Optum program, which is a United Healthcare ISNP program, and I have 18 facilities and 9 advanced practice clinicians on my team. We've had significant loss on our team. As of March 1st, we had approximately 590 members throughout those 18 buildings, and as of this morning, we're down to 462. So we've lost about 130 members in the last several months. I'm happy to share my experience with you.
Yes, yes. And I we didn't like draw straws or do any coin toss, but I want to hear from both of you and understand your insights on what recovery has looked like for those patients who've been fortunate enough to survive this condition. And Liz, we could go ahead and we could start with you.
Okay. I took a poll of my team, especially the nurse practitioners who have seen the volume in their buildings and the significant loss in their buildings. And overwhelmingly, the number one thing that we're seeing now in this, I call it, you know, post-COVID period, but I really don't know that it's post-COVID. But for the people that were diagnosed in, let's say, April or May, and now have negative tests, and that's probably the best way to define these folks. But the overwhelming response from my nurse practitioners is the appetite suppression that continues to be ongoing, the anorexia. We've seen significant weight loss, about 10-15% approximately of the total body weight, as well as the hypoalbuminemia worsening, which it, you know, is not necessarily uncommon in this population, but it, you know, definitely worsening. And, you know, the question arises then whether this appetite suppression is from a GI disturbance associated with COVID, or if it's actually the loss of taste and smell. And a lot of our members, you know, cannot tell us if that sensation is missing. So we have, you know, suspicion about that. And, you know, I've been reading some articles, and this really is not really well documented so far in the literature, the appetite suppression and the weight loss. But the smell and taste loss, you know, they're saying that maybe 6-8 weeks that this continues. I have some anecdotal experience with people telling me that it's much beyond that. And I'd love to hear what Dr. Healy says if you've seen that as well. So we're seeing, you know, that this is really the overwhelming ongoing issue in this population. And of course, then this is leading to multiple other things. You know, dehydration, they just have, you know, poor oral intake, worsening renal failure, maybe associated hypotension, failure to thrive, combined with not only the frailty of their overall decline, but also like physical frailty and significant muscle loss. I guess the sarcopenia has been significant combined with new onset dysphagia. And many of these folks have been in bed for 3 months. You know, they're not only not getting out of their room and socially isolated, but they literally have been in bed for 3 months, not even in most of my facilities, not getting into chairs at their bedside. So the muscle wasting, dysphagia, probably dysphagia associated with that as well, has been a problem. So this kind of all falls under that, you know, appetite suppression, failure to thrive headline, I would say.
And Dr. Healy, can you describe what you've seen?
Sure, I will. I thought, first of all, thank you for inviting me back. And it's a great opportunity for me to look back and reflect and understand where we are relative to where we've been. And I hadn't really done that before, so it was a great opportunity to reflect on it. And I did also interview a number of my nurse practitioners, medical staff, rehab staff, nursing staff. And so what I'm going to share is based on largely their input. I thought I would just start quickly with the timeline. I think it might help you to understand where you are sort of relative to me, and that might be of some assistance to you. And if you want to, I always go back to March 1st. It's easy to remember that date. And that was when, roughly, give or take a day or two, the first case was discovered in New York, which was in New Rochelle. We went very quickly over the next couple of weeks to, you know, closing down our facility for visitation, trying to figure out, you know, how to manage our infection control program, screening staff, and doing rounds and so on and so forth. We suffered a great deal from lack of testing. I don't know if that is the case in Florida or in all of Florida, but my facility in particular, our lab provider, just there were no tests, and it was virtually impossible to get tests. So we had a kind of a dark period where we didn't really know who had it. We had a lot of people on transmission-based precautions. We weren't sure if they had it or not. Then we got our hands on some tests and we went around and tested people, and lo and behold, there it was in our facility roughly the third week of March. So that's when we realized that we really had it. Around that time, you are all probably aware of the March 25th decree from Governor Cuomo that said that nursing homes in New York had to accept all comers from hospitals, and you couldn't discriminate and you couldn't ask about COVID. And long story short, we ended up at that point creating a COVID unit. So we took what was our subacute unit and transformed it into a 40-bed COVID unit. And then we moved a lot of our long-term patients up to that unit. So we had sort of this conglomerate of people, some of whom had been tested, some were PUIs, some came from the hospital, and it was all very kind of nebulous back then. And I call them dark gray days, and it was bad weather too. So really, really a tough time. And April was the month of our peak experience. We had a die-off, I call it a die-off, of our long-term care residents. We lost around 25 residents in over the course of a few weeks. So, and those people died quickly. So they were sick for a day or two, and then they died, and that was it, or else they died suddenly. So the first round of deaths was, you know, people that succumbed very, very rapidly. Then there was the group of people who you knew had it and they went on to recover, and we'll talk about them in more detail. And then there were the late, what I call the late phase deaths. So we'll get to that in a moment. So basically, starting in April, things started to get a little bit better. In mid-April, we got diagnostic testing. We did have some guidelines for discontinuation of transmission-based precautions that were clinical guidelines that we adopted. The CDC, as you know, just put out some guidelines, but New York put some out early on, and we used them, and we were able, using them, to discontinue transmission-based precautions because we just had a glut of patients on this unit, and we didn't quite know who could go and who couldn't. So crossed my fingers, if you will, sent a lot of people back to their units, and it was fine. No new onset of infection. So we emptied out our unit. April 30th was our last death, our last COVID death. So we're almost 2 months out from our last death. And our last positive test, last new case was May 12th. So just to give you an idea of where we are, by June, we'd emptied out our COVID unit. So no more COVID in this facility in almost 2 months. And we have, you're probably aware that now there's an executive order that you can't send anyone to a nursing home in New York unless they've tested negative. So coming in, don't have it, allegedly. We do still quarantine them. And we just did a whole house test of our residents back in early June. We came up with a couple of positives we didn't know about. They were asymptomatic. We quarantined them, and now they're all back. So we're in this phase of, right now, no cases. And that's been the case for quite some time. Now, in terms of what happened with those individuals, mostly I'm going to focus on our long-term patients, which I thought was what you would wanted to hear about. Very difficult rehabbing these cases. And, you know, basically it was the feedback I got was uncharted territory, trial and error, very unpredictable. And as you may recall, or maybe you're going through now, the rules changed every day. You had one plan in place on Monday, on Tuesday or Wednesday, you changed it. So there was a lot of, sort of resetting. And that, I think, was a significant issue and continues to be, as we have to divert a lot of cognitive energy into figuring out what we're doing and how it changed from yesterday. So it was a big learning curve for the staff in terms of what we were doing internally. And that was reflected in also in the changes in the residents. So the people that got sick with COVID in terms of how they were different was that there was I'll start with what Elizabeth also mentioned, profound weight loss and sarcopenia. And this resulted in profound weakness. And as a result, the ability to tolerate rehab was diminished. And everyone sort of had to change their approach to patients. You know, the classic 1 hour of OT and 45 minutes of PT and that kind of thing. That was, all bets were off, because you would find the same patient varied day to day. They might have done very well on Monday, and Tuesday they can't even sit up. And Wednesday you come back and they're better, and Thursday they're flat out again. And this was quite different than what the rehab folks had usually experienced, where it's more or less linear. You know, there'd be an occasional setback, but you're more or less progressing. So this was all bets off. They could be doing great one day, terrible the next. Lots of cognitive issues, lots of delirium, more so than and in other illnesses. So residents, again, the carryover of what they learned one day to the next was significant. There were a lot of hallucinations and just inability to focus. So rehab had to switch how they did things. Sometimes they would go in three times a day to the same patient to do 30 minutes, 10 minutes each. Some days they would have to skip. It was very, very much, you know, a new game every day. Dysphagia was also a significant issue, as Elizabeth pointed out, and they needed a lot of assistance with eating. And again, there's a lot of weight loss. So this was sort of the rehab experience. I'll just mention very quickly the late phase losses, and then we'll get to where we're at today with those patients that recovered. So there were those individuals, the majority, who got sick with COVID, who died quickly. And then there was a cohort of people who kind of just, they seemed like they were getting better, then they just ultimately succumbed. And we felt that those individuals were frail at baseline. So if you survived the initial onset, your prognosis wasn't that good if you were frail at baseline. And some of those individuals died of aspiration. And so they're just really weak, 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 and then one day aspirated and gone. And some had wounds and wound infections. So recovery, what can we say? So, Diane, you asked me, were the residents, did they have any respiratory complications, lingering cardiac issues, neurologic challenges, et cetera? And the answer is no. Those people that survived to recovery, and Elizabeth, maybe again, we're 4 or more weeks out from where you guys are and you're in the acute phase, they have recovered almost back to baseline from a functional status. A lot of it had to do with lots of increased work once they finished their rehab and got back to their units. The nursing staff had a lot more work to do in feeding. And to your point again of, you know, perhaps the loss of taste and smell and the increased work of just getting the food into them, it required a lot of intense staff effort to get these people to eat again. Not everyone has regained their baseline weight, but almost 100% who survived regained their baseline function, which is counterintuitive. You would have thought you were, you know, going to be left with just a unit of people that were, you know, shades or shadows of what they had been. About 10% have lingering cognitive issues and a diminished cognition, you know, that we can recognize, just not the man that used to read the Times, he's not reading it anymore, that kind of thing. But so you do notice it, but most seem to have recovered. So the lessons that that mostly the rehab staff wanted to share was understand how much more time you need really to do everything. And I think we've all experienced it, just getting in and out of the building. You know, you're screening, you're putting on a mask, you're hand sanitizing, you're doing all extra stuff. And with rehab, particularly in the acute phases, you know, the time to don and doff PPE, and sanitize their equipment. And then again, working with people who are just not able to tolerate what they used to be, really impacted on their, you know, the bottom line. Unfortunately for rehab, it's about productivity in many cases. But that, that was the big issue for them. And again, I think we all should acknowledge, I call it cognitive fatigue on our part. It's just a lot more steps to do what you do in a daily basis. If you do have a COVID unit, the staff really appreciated what we came up with towards the end, which is we had separate donning and doffing areas for the PPE. We had a separate room for donning and a separate room for doffing with different instructions. Your donning instructions, your doffing instructions. The staff found that very, very helpful, because before it was all just kind of a big mess, everybody doing what they have to do. And mostly they said that, you know, if it comes again, I suppose it will, that just knowing that there's that kind of variability from day to day will really help our staff. Because before, if somebody declined after a day or so, you know, it was hands off, they're done. You know, we can't keep rehabbing them. And now they know there's going to be this sort of literally roller coaster ride, and they expect it. And they think that that's important to know. And then also that they found it very important to constantly check vital signs on patients when you were doing rehab. So basically now we're just kind of, you know, waiting to see what happens. We're waiting to reopen for visitation. We're testing staff once a week, nasopharyngeal swabbing, and that's going on through at least August. No more nursing home resident testing unless it's, you know, based on an, you know, finding of some.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
Somebody new, and that's where we're at.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you. I mean,
there's hope.
That's what I heard. I'm like, no new cases. I was like, I think I circled that 1,000 times. I really hope we get to that place. I'm not sure if we're about 2 months behind where New York was at. It feels like it may be that situation. And you guys both have given me a lot of really great information. I'm curious to know, from the onset of the condition to the point where they tested negative, when we're looking at the rehab period, You both mentioned that it's a little bit difficult, and Dr. Healy, you said that we have to extend it. How many weeks of rehab were you seeing that would be necessary to get that person back to baseline? How many weeks did it take?
I'd say you're looking at 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah. And has
they're really sick? They're flat out. They're flat out, you know, at best you can do passive range. And then once they get a little better, there's all this variability. So quite a longer time.
And Alyssa, are you seeing that same?
You know, honestly, I mean, I'm very grateful to hear what you've had to say, Dr. Healy, because it gives us hope. And honestly, I don't think that we are quite there yet. I think we're just starting to have people enter some rehabilitation, but we're not there yet. And my rule of thumb has always been, you know, whatever you, the amount of time that a person stays in bed, they have to do double that amount of time in rehabilitation. That's been my rule of thumb throughout my career. And it's very interesting, the things that you're saying, Dr. Healy, because I mean, I have, you know, I went through and kind of listed maybe five major points that I'm seeing in this post-COVID era. And, you know, you've touched on many of them. So it's interesting that you're seeing the same things we're seeing down here. You know, to discuss the neurodegeneration and their ability to truly enter therapy and to digest the information and improve is questionable. We're seeing, you know, a decline. We check our MMSEs on our patients every 6 months and with post-hospital discharge. So we're seeing at least 4 to 6 point drop in the MMSE, and in some cases, much more drastic than that. So those people, I think, are the ones that are, like you said, are maybe your second or third phase of people that they're lingering and you know, still kind of questionable on their recovery, their ability to recover. And the other thing that I've seen that's very interesting that you mentioned, but we're seeing in about 2 to 4 weeks after having negative COVID testing, that they have an acute decline in death. And that's happened twice on our team in the last 2 weeks, where we thought someone was recovering. You know, maybe they had a small pneumonia that we were treating, and then the next day they die very quickly. And so my question and my thought is, how long is this like post-inflammatory hypercoagulable state occurring in these folks? I don't know if Dr. Healy, if you all were using Lovenox during your COVID period for the people that kept in house or not. I know that there are some practices down here using Lovenox, but I know that they're not extending it for 4 weeks after negative testing. And so my thought is that these couple folks in the last few weeks that we've lost acutely, that it was likely to be a PE, although we'll never really know, or maybe a CVA. So I'd love to know your thoughts on that as well.
You know, it's interesting. I was sort of digesting what you were saying, and we saw that phenomena more in the beginning. I can't say that I experienced the late sudden death. So there was the lots of sudden death early, and including those that you didn't think had it. Just somebody died all of a sudden. Someone had COVID in one room and the guy across the hall would die. And you'd say, what? You know, he didn't have anything. He probably did. But that kind of stuff was going on in the beginning. And I haven't experienced that, but I would have to say we used the anticoagulation sporadically. It was not across the board. We allowed, you know, for that to be used. We gave the guidelines that the hospitals were using, and some people used it. I tended to use it, you know, if they had high D-dimer levels and so forth, but we did not experience that phenomena that you're mentioning. It's much to be learned from this. It really
is. Yes, absolutely.
Like a different trajectory that you're describing.
Have you been using any kind of appetite stimulants on your folks with the prolonged anorexia? I know that there are some practices in our area that are using Magace, and my team's really avoiding the use of Magace just because of its thrombolytic potential.
Correct.
Have you been using anything else like Remeron or anything?
We've added Remeron in some cases when the people looked, you know, like they were a little depressed or apathetic. We toss it on. And hard to know. I mean, I don't have enough numbers to suggest that it made a difference. But I know I used it in a couple of patients.
And Liz, they're starting appetite stimulants when they get back from the hospital, or you know, when they just see that there's an issue or decline without considerations around Lovenox or anything else. I'm just curious to know the reasoning, I guess.
Yeah, I think most of the people that have been started on Remeron also hinted or leaned a little bit more towards a depressive presentation as well. So, and maybe, you know, anxiety with sleep disturbance. So trying to kind of kill as many birds with one stone as we can. But it has made a difference, not necessarily as much in the appetite stimulation, but, you know, letting them rest better at night and maybe helping their depression. Depression has been a huge, you know, with the social isolation, really not communicating very much with the families. The only people that they see are their caregivers just intermittently. That's been a huge factor for us as well.
And then you were leading me, you've answered my next question around that. I was just curious to know when we are, the difference in the populations and how social isolation is impacting those who had initially tested positive and who may have recovered. I do want to know, you know, you both mentioned the loss of smell, loss of taste, and I know Dr. Zorwitz shared an article in the chat that we will place in our library. How long before you saw a return of the sense of taste, the smell in your population?
You know, as Elizabeth mentioned, it's hard to say because it's, you know, we're presuming that they have a loss of taste and smell as part of the reason for their anorexia, but they're not necessarily describing that. So I think, you know, knowing from other people that have had COVID, including our staff members, that got it around the same time, some have still not recovered. So we're talking potentially a number of weeks, 8 or more weeks. But anecdotally, I'm hearing, around 4 weeks for that.
Yeah. And I would imagine if, you know, I appreciate you saying that the people who are now recovered and gone through rehab, you haven't seen any of those complications. Mm-hmm. But in that period of rehab, the dysphagia, the weight loss, all of those things, would imagine puts them at increased risk for aspirating, an increased risk for bed sores. Have we seen any of those things in that group who were titling as recovered?
Yeah, we did observe for people that, and we called them late phase deaths, the ones that, and they started out a little more on the more frail side or end of the spectrum. They didn't improve and they kind of lingered. And then aspiration was a factor in a couple of them. So one of the things lessons learned is about positioning, you know, really have to consider how we're positioning them at, post meals and so forth. That would be an important factor. Aspiration and wound infection for those later deaths.
How has the conversation, the advanced care planning conversation, changed when you're thinking, okay, the patient has now recovered, but there are other issues that may be apparent, as you both have mentioned? How has that changed that advanced care planning conversation?
Well, I think, interestingly, the families are more receptive to discussions now. Now that they understand, you know, that this is a condition or a problem that that the elderly are just not going to do well with, you know, no matter what you do. And it's different now than it was in the beginning. In the beginning, there was a cohort of people that, wanted their family member transferred to the hospital. There's a cohort of people that didn't want their family member transferred to the hospital. I think now they're more understanding, particularly, you know, it's been so long, and they realize this is not something that's going to go away. It wasn't a one-time thing. It wasn't the flu. It's, you know, not an illness that there's going to be a cure for. And they realize that you know, that their loved ones are at risk, and they're more open, I think, to those discussions than they had been, or to you know, accepting or having a DNR, DNI status, and, you know, a lot more discussion around hospitalization, more productive than it had been.
And Liz, have you observed the same in your population?
Absolutely, yes. You know, we've had a mix as well. We've had the families who, you know, because we talk about advanced care planning very commonly in our practice, we've had the families who said, oh, no, I certainly don't want my family member to go to the hospital, no matter what it is, unless it's traumatic. And then they rescinded their do not hospitalize order. Because I think part of it was fear, part of it was the anxiety that they had not seen them, and the isolation. So we did have a fair number of people, and we still are seeing that throughout the state, even people who were on hospice, and the families are wanting them to go to the hospital as well. And then you have the other side of the coin, where they're amenable to the conversation and understanding that this may not fare too well for their family member. So yeah, we've seen both ways.
Okay. And the question that I guess has been like sort of lingering in my mind, if I am at the table with the DON and the administrator and rehab, pharmacy, everyone, what would that care plan that we need to write up for a patient who's post-COVID look like, you know? And it's a big question, but what are the things that maybe we haven't considered, given everything that you've explained to us, and what we're seeing with some reports that people are having fever 4 weeks out, people are having the DVTs and pulmonary embolism 6 weeks out. You know, if I was trying to, and no perfect situation, but if I was trying to design a program to really take care of these patients, what would that look like? And whoever wants to go first can go first.
Go ahead, Dr. Healy.
You know, I kind of don't know how to answer that, because it's, and again, I'll go back to saying that I'm very grateful that I was asked to participate, because it made me realize where we are as an organization in a way that I mean, I think I was just so relieved. Oh, God, there's no cases. You know, we're always dealing with something, and the intensity of it all has dropped. So maybe I was sort of mentally checked out a little bit. Now that I realize where we are, I would have to get back to you about that, whether it really is different. The message that I got that surprised me as much as you in the time that I was really working on this is that it's not different. They're not different, mostly not different. Once they get over that long, you know, road, they come back and they're not different substantially.
Very encouraging.
That's what they say. Yeah. So I think it's more, you know, the recovering person is, you know, you've got to be on a lot all the time, and probably bringing to care plan more often, and just constantly looking at them and tweaking. But once they kind of get over that hump, they're back, you know, on the regular cycle, seems.
And Liz, anything that to add?
You know, we're really not there yet, honestly. So I, like I said, we're just starting to initiate some therapy, in our buildings. And I think our road, we are probably 2 months out before I'll be able to, you know, discuss how our people are doing. I hope that they rebound. My sense is that from where we are right now, you know, there's been such a decline in them from, you know, the muscle atrophy and the neurological decline and, you know, the depression. And there's so many, it's so multifactorial that I can't see it right now, but I'm very grateful to know that there is some hope to get there in a couple of months.
Yeah, I agree. And we are going to actually jump ahead to our open discussion because there's been so many questions posed in our chat. And I'm going to start with Dr. Auslander. I believe you had a question, a comment about anticoagulation.
Yes, yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Diane? Yes, I can.
Yeah, a couple of things. Thank you very much for the presentation. It was really very interesting. I wanted to just ask you the question about in terms of the patients that you think might have had a hypercoagulable state from COVID, do you think that's what it was, or was it just the risks of the acute illness and bed rest? And the reason I ask that question is we in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, we just published online a study from nursing homes in Europe that didn't show any difference in outcomes among those with COVID who were on an anticoagulant and were not. So I'm just not sure whether if what you're seeing, what you're describing is a hypercoagulable state or not. And the other comment I'd make is about the appetite suppression. One of the speakers mentioned Migues, and Migues has no evidence behind it, and it only has side effects, and it has hypercoagulable side effects. Yeah. So I would strongly discourage anyone from using Migues for anything, but in particular in people with COVID. So I'd like to hear your comments on that.
So, and again, I'm just giving the experience that we've had here at United Hebrew. I don't know that it's generalizable, but we saw the peak number of deaths in those early weeks, and there were a number of people that died. I should really have clarified this, and this is part of what we're struggling with in terms of the statistics around COVID deaths, I think, as a nation. At least certainly in New York, is there were people that died that we didn't think had COVID, but they died in excess numbers. And I don't know why they died. They just died. I mean, you come in the morning and so-and-so had keeled over and died at dinner and wasn't even sick. And we don't know why they died. I mean, certainly you can invoke a PE as something that could cause sudden death. Like that, or an arrhythmia, of course. I mean, there's only a couple of things that can really do that to you. But I don't know. I don't know why they died. But they died quickly. So we didn't really have them on our radar screen, many of them, to have even been considering anticoagulation or measuring, you know, their to see if there was coagulopathy in terms of D-dimer elevation, that they just, you know, it was too quick. So I don't know really what happened to them. And I think that's a big question and one that I'm trying to find out, at least what the numbers are. I've asked and made a FOIL request of New York State to see how many people really did die in the nursing home in those weeks, because we really don't even know. But I suspect they died in far greater numbers, and they died of something that COVID, I believe COVID was causing, that we haven't recognized. I guess that's more questions than answers to what you said, but.
Yeah, it's a good observation, and it's an interesting Interesting thought, okay. For sure.
Go ahead, Liz.
And I was just going to say, I honestly don't know about these particular situations that occurred last week for our team. Although the people were definitely in that, you know, post-COVID period, several weeks, and we thought they were slowly on the road to recovery, and then suddenly an event occurred. And I don't know what it was, not that we'll ever know, but I question whether it was symbolic.
And Liz, for those people, they were initially positive, tested negative, and then went back to the hospital
Never went back to the hospital. Okay. We're really like recovering at the facility.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they were recovered. So did you just see a sudden respiratory decline in their respiratory status or?
Literally the one patient that I'm thinking of from last week, she was fine in the morning. And what the nurse went in to see her after lunch and she had passed.
Yeah. It really makes me wonder, and I would ask both of you, what if there were any labs or anything that we should be monitoring and thinking about the patients that we're receiving back from the hospital? Like, should we be beyond the CBC and maybe chemistries? Would there be anything that you've noticed in your populations that may have helped to monitor?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No. I mean, the thing that we started doing really on all of our residents every shift is the O2 sat in addition to the temperature monitoring. And I don't know that we found anybody that we wouldn't have found otherwise, but we felt that, you know, the people that we did recognize when we saw that they were succumbing, obviously they had this decline in O2 sat, so that's been it.
Okay. We weren't routinely monitoring anything like D-dimers either.
No.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I'm not suggesting we should. I'm just curious to know what has happened. We had a question about if we would consider pooling staff specimens moving forward for weekly surveillance if prevalence is low. And I guess, and Dr. Healy, your situation with no new cases, you guys are testing weekly. Is that something that you would recommend to continue going forward?
Well, we're mandated to do that by the DOH. So we don't have much choice. But I will say that, I don't think it's a bad idea. I think the pooled, I'm not that familiar with the pool testing. What little I do know about it, it might make more sense in terms of preserving, you know, resources. And I will tell you, it's kind of ridiculous.
So the, 5 days is a long time to get a test result. Does anyone know how quickly the turnaround is for the curative test that is being done here in Florida for staff?
Our Pixel results are taking 4 to 6 days.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. We our first round took about five, six days. But they're sending the results by email now. It may get quicker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, in Central Florida, some of them are relatively shorter, like 2 to 4 days. My last came back in 2 days, actually.
Yeah. When I was tested, mine came back within 48 hours. So it's unfortunate that there's still so much variability. We will be back to our standard day and time next week. And we look forward to talking to you all again. Thank you.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-acute care.